It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
He was licking me.
What?
He was licking me!
Lunch Hour Reviews.
This man ate till he burst.
So he did die by eating.
Lunch Hour Reviews.
I'm tainting me.
Tainting me!
It's feeding time.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
So in this episode of our Lunch Hour Reviews series, we're going to be talking about American Horror Story Hotel.
Yay, finally.
Yeah, so the ambitious goal is to week by week of the Lunch Hour Reviews, so interspersed with longer episodes, we're going to talk about the series of American Horror Story on FX, figuring from the most fresh to the one we've seen longest ago.
Time. I'll tell you, I'm not looking forward at all to Coven. Yeah. I hope maybe the second time around I'll like it more, but I doubt it.
I'm concerned that our episode on Coven is going to be like 5 minutes long and be like, well, that sucked. This is terrible.
This was terrible.
But in this case, Hotel, we both liked. You liked from the time it was airing.
I was obsessed
with it. Way late comer. I had to buy the season on iTunes. But I don't regret it. I dug it quite a bit. So American Horror Story kind of blends a couple locations into the storyline. It takes place at the Hotel Cortez. It's supposed to be in L.A. It's downtown L.A. Mm-hmm. And it is directly taken from the Hotel Cecil, the Cecil, which is an actual hotel in downtown L.A. that you can book a room if you don't mind haunted hotels where creepy shit happens.
I always want to book a room. For business, I go to this one town, and there's a haunted hotel there, and never get to book a room there.
Because it's always
full, because you have to book on a specific floor.
Ah.
I know. It's disappointing every time.
Okay, tell them you have a horror-based podcast, and maybe that'll kind of give you the...
Maybe. There's always like a sporting event there, and the sporting guys stay there.
Oh, that's so much more boring.
I know.
So the Cecil in downtown L.A. might have come to people's attention because a couple years ago, Elisa Lam was found in their water tank on the roof. And she was naked and locked in there. And there's elevator footage. Like, there's document to show her at the hotel behaving oddly. People speculate as to whether or not, like, she was alone, whether she committed suicide. I think she might have been noted as being bipolar. But in any case, how she got inside the water tower...
How do you even do that? We have very few left in New York water tower things.
Well, that are in use. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just like decorative rooftop ornaments.
Yeah, old-fashioned things now.
Yeah, but really creepily, people in the hotel were complaining about bad water pressure.
Oh, God.
And a funny taste to the water coming out of the sink.
That's because you're drinking
and
people.
Yeah, there's your Soylent Green moment where they investigated and they found a body in the water and still no clear indicator as to like how the hell she got in there, what she put in there. It's kind of a creepy mystery. But for a hotel that's had a number of suicides and some famous people to stay there, like Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker.
Right.
And a guy I'd never heard of, an Austrian serial killer by the name of Jack Unterweger. Unterweger? I'm assuming that W is meant to be a V sound. This guy was terrifying. Like, he was an international lady killer, and he committed suicide after the cops were on to him. And yeah, so the Cecil proper
had some people of note staying there.
Yeah, there's some bad juju there. So it was a direct influence in shaping the Cortez. And it's funny, looking up the Cortez, I had it confused. I thought there were a couple themes in terms of like the Fountain of Youth, the sort of,
sure.
You know, link to eternity, but that's actually Ponce de Leon. That's not Cortez, the conquistador from Spain. But okay, so...
Well, I think also worth noting, And this character, but the hotel as well, is involved with H.H. Holmes. I think, you know, that's a big part when you finally see how the Cortez was put together and when it's being built in the show and you see kind of the plans. It's absolutely out of that, you know, using multiple contractors, multiple architects. And I think that's pretty awesome. Very close.
Yeah, to the, what do they call it? Like the Death Castle?
Yeah, something the castle.
In Chicago?
Yeah.
So turn of the century, H.H. Holmes. The building of his hotel reminds me of like the Winchester Mystery House. If every curious architectural decision was plotted for the purpose of murder.
Right, exactly, exactly. And so this hotel, it has rooms that are just chutes down into the basement, because
yeah,
why not? Well, yeah. You gotta
There's
throw
an entire corridor
easily.
Sealed off.
Yeah, just put that there.
I love that, like, his interaction with the contractor, like, doesn't end well, but it was sort of symbolic of, like, H.H. Holmes scammed so many people. Mm-hmm. Like, before there was a grid to be on, H.H. Holmes was, like, committing fraud
right,
in every potential venue. So, like, conning these guys out of their work. A number of people were disappeared. He's changed his own identity. What was his original name? It was, like, Mudgett?
Yeah, it's a very, like,
in
Harry
all fairness,
Potter kind of name.
Yeah, I would change my name if my name was Mudgett. But in any case, so yeah, so H.H. Holmes plays into it in a big way, too. And he's portrayed on screen by
Evan Peters.
Evan Peters, who, let me never forget his name again, because he's been in every season uh-huh. of American Horror Story. Uh-huh. And he's probably the best element
he is the
of
I
the
mean,
series.
This, the Hotel, hold on, what do I want to say? I get so excited when I talk about Evan Peters. In Hotel, he's top notch. I think there's no one beating him. And I think Gaga's great in this, but Evan Peters steals the show. He's hilarious. He keeps going with this character that's just horrible and revolting, but he's the way he does it is so fucking charming.
I was going to say charming as hell. That he is... You know, I don't know that there is recorded document of H.H. Holmes or what he sounded like, but he was a guy who arrived in Chicago and right. was like, this city is just chaotic enough that I can sort of fly unnoticed.
Right, exactly.
But here, J.P. March is like, he is a showman. It's mm-hmm. funny that the season before this was Freak Show and there was a proper ringleader, but, you know, Peters was not it. In this, he steps up as like the ringmaster yeah. and he's like an old Hollywood character who's just like, you know, ladies and gentlemen, one and all, please come to the Hotel Death. Like yeah. it's just
he's like very old timey the entire time.
Yeah. And he's got a sense of the theatric. But at the same time, like he's also like plotting and, yeah. You know, creepy because there's
he
no
says some of the worst
hiding.
Lines in the whole show, but yeah. he doesn't. It's so charming and you just laugh. You can't help yourself.
Secret rooms, hinged walls, acid pits, asphyxiation chambers. Are you familiar with my black closet?
Another series regular is Sarah Paulson.
Oh,
who
yeah.
I originally knew from Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. And I was
I
like,
never had known
she
her
is
before.
A triple threat. Like, she can sing, she can dance, she can act. And in this is probably the most tragic of the characters that she's yeah. played. Because yeah. she's playing, like, well, she's playing Sally, who's, well, we should talk about the hotel as this sort of vortex of death and spirits, because yeah. The hotel kind of acts as this anchor for the macabre. So Sally arrives there in 1993, right?
1994. Well, is when
she first
expires in 1994.
Okay. So she is a relic of the 90s, and
yes,
she's
100%. Oh my God.
She's
I love
kind
her.
Of like a even more tragic Courtney Love.
Who yeah.
She's just like, you know, if the show's represented by like the acting, like the comedy tragedy mask, she is inherently tragedy.
Yeah.
And just long suffering. You really feel bad for
she's
Sally.
She's crying in almost every scene. She's in tears.
And smoking. And, she's smoking
well, of course,
and crying.
There's a lot of smoking.
I was thinking about it. This show, maybe even more than Mad Men, has so much smoking.
You know, I was watching Preacher last night, and I thought the same. I thought that about Preacher. I yeah. thought this has more smoking than Mad Men.
AMC loves
yeah.
their. I mean, it's funny. You can't advertise cigarettes on television, right. but AMC would be the first to do it.
Exactly, and you know, you and I were talking about that the other day, and you think everyone looks grosser smoking, but I was like, kind of makes some people look cooler.
I eventually, by the end of this, I came to love Big Brother. I was watching yeah. people smoke on screen and I was like, is
They're
American
so
Horror
cool.
Story, are they trying to make smoking hip again? Because it's working.
Because they look pretty fucking cool for ghosts.
Tell me you love me. say hey!
Say, I love you, Sally. And it will all go away. Say it.
I love you, Sally.
Say it again.
Okay, we have to talk about Wes Bentley. Wes Bentley features really heavily in this show.
I wish he didn't. You know, when I was watching it over again, I just fast-forwarded through most of his parts, similar to how I fast-forward through the governor's parts of Walking Dead.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was much more enjoyable.
Without his
Without Wes Bentley. But he's a main, huge part of the show.
Yeah.
So and we have to talk about it.
His character is a detective, and he... It's funny, everybody in the show is kind of modeled... on a genre, modeled on characters we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else in the cast, I think maybe with the exception of Chloe Sevigny, but everybody else in the cast is a fine actor.
Yes.
And they, like, there is no confusion as to what they are going for. Wes mm-hmm. Bentley leaves it as vague as his scruffy Batman voice. Like
I think he's so terrible. And I remember when I talked about this the first time when I was actually watching it, when we talked about it the first time, and I said, I don't understand what he's trying to do. And if someone knows what he's trying to do, someone let me know.
You and your parents, who were versed very well in the horror genre, could not figure out what the hell his character was supposed to be.
I still can't figure out what he was supposed to be.
So the closest I come to like nailing down what he was an homage to is like the 1940s LA Confidential kind of detectives who would be pursuing the Black Dahlia case.
See, because I had him as a Hitchcock guy because he's very dapper, the suits and everything like that. But that's as far as I could get with
it. Yeah, I don't know how much I can't think of too many like Hitchcock sort of anti-hero. You know, it was mm-hmm. the days before like your rough and tumble cop who's got some dirt on him. So I think Wes Bentley is somewhere between like a Black Dahlia era detective and maybe right into like the sort of stereotype 80s leading into the 90s, almost Dirty Harry cop who doesn't play by the rules.
Right.
And that goddamn effect, like he puts on a gruffly Batman voice.
Batman voice. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a Batman voice.
And it removes any humanity and inflection in what he's doing. And so for a character who sadly is prominently featured in the show, we should say that like Ryan Murphy, brilliant on a number of levels, seems to have a sad soft spot for Wes Bentley because he keeps putting him in this.
He does. When he showed up in Freak Show, and we'll talk about it, I guess, the next time when we do Freak Show, but like, god damn it, I wish he wasn't there.
Wes Bentley's character, Detective John Lowe, is married to Chloe Sevigny's character, Alex, who, and we were talking about it earlier today, Chloe Sevigny is, you know, I don't know if she's Oscar nominated, but she should have been at this point for Boys Don't Cry.
Boys Don't Cry, she was excellent in.
And even specific to this, like I love Zodiac, and I thought she was fine in that.
Yeah, you love that movie.
But she's playing a plain Jane. She's not supposed to sort of deter the story, or detour the story, rather. In this, she's kind of a committed mother and a doctor.
Yeah.
And has gotten by this far without much personality.
Yeah, she has no personality. She's the most boring person in this show.
Yeah,
like,
I think
so boring. She's actually a terrible mother because she really couldn't care less about the daughter.
No, they have
mean
one
to the husband like crazy.
Their young son, their like seemingly albino son, goes missing at an early age, and that kind of breaks the family apart. And she never comes back from that. And it's so fucked up that she loved that boy more than she loved her husband or her daughter put together. And so That's a weird thing to like ask us to empathize with or relate to.
Well, you know, I'm an only child, so I kind of understand, because I think like when parents say I don't have a favorite, I think that's a big fucking lie. The parents clearly have a favorite child.
Maybe not collectively, but like each parent definitely relates to a kid more.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, whatever. It's common enough, but in this case, it's pretty exaggerated.
Yeah. It's just like, damn, you know, at least you got to pretend like, you know, you don't think that way.
Then Holden showed up. It was a tectonic shift where everything I thought I knew about myself got rearranged. It was like I finally fell in love for real. All the cracks and missing pieces came together. I felt whole. I'd found my soulmate.
She's terrible in it. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of hers.
I liked her a lot in season two.
She was fine. I'm just not a huge fan of hers. And, you know, there's a particular scene in one of her movies where I think it's called acting so you don't actually have to do the act.
Are you talking about Brown Bunny?
I am. If you were a good enough actor, you wouldn't actually have to do it.
She was young and impressionable. And Vincent Gallo seems like a master manipulator.
Okay, fair enough. But I'll never get over that. I'll never get over it because it's called fucking acting.
Next up is a huge Dennis O'Hare as Liz Taylor. Mm-hmm. I think is probably a lot of people's favorite character by the end of the show.
He comes out being very, I mean, there's two characters I love together, and then he would be the next one.
His story arc is absolutely the best mm-hmm. in the show. But so Dennis O'Hare, for those who maybe have seen a commercial here or there, he is the bald. He regards himself as Liz Taylor. He regards himself as a woman.
Right.
You know, they get into the details of whether or not he's like pre or post-op, but mm-hmm. he is a glamorous fellow. And right. And I was thinking that, like, I don't know anything about the actor, but what you were saying before that, like, hey, man, acting means like transforming right. and, you know, sort of going beyond. And for him to affect, you know, his character of Liz Taylor and glow.
Right.
Is something else.
You just, and you feel like you just love Liz so much, and she's so glamorous, and she just, every scene that she's in, you just steals the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Glow is totally right because she's so vibrant, glamorous and caring, and there's just so much life in that character. I really love Dennis O'Hare in this.
I was a salesman in another life. In this one, I'm the mother of style. Cut me and I bleed Dior.
Yeah, so playing against him is Kathy Bates, and I think they probably made her the character Iris as they did to sort of contrast right. with Dennis O'Hare, because, you know, it's funny, Kathy Bates, especially the first couple episodes, you might think she's doing like a Halloween cosplay of George Romero.
Yes.
She's kind of like, she's dressed
like George
she's
Romero.
Wearing his glasses.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but you know, initially I thought, like, you know, maybe she's sort of a subtle manipulator. Maybe she's kind of playing like Stanley Kubrick of sorts and proves to be this, like, you know, greater mind. But no, yeah. She's actually not dissimilar to Sarah Paulson. She is kind of like this long-suffering character
yes,
who
but you know what? She really likes tragic. It. She's very tragic, but at the same time, she likes it. I mean, I don't know. I grew up with some friends who had like parents like that were very similar to that, like go in and get you out of the house kind of parents. And I don't have a lot of sympathy for it because a lot of what the kids, number one, are usually acting that way because the parents are so awful.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not always directly, but in her case, it's definitely like a long pattern.
Hey, Dono, I've been waiting for you. Look, you need any help packing? I printed out some Craigslist ads for apartments for us, some nice two bedrooms. And this one, this is the building in Santa Monica where they captured Whitey Bulger. Look at it, it's glamorous, right?
I will live with the addicts in Shitter's Alley, in a box in MacArthur Park, covered in the piss and shit of this horror of a city, before I even consider living under the same roof as you again.
You're a drama queen.
She comes to the hotel mm-hmm. by way of stalking her own child.
Right.
Matt Bomer plays Donovan.
Right.
And a real handsome fella.
Very handsome fella.
Looks a little bit like the new Superman, whatever.
But handsomer.
Doesn't, yeah.
More
doesn't,
handsome.
Yeah. So her coming to the hotel has everything to do with Donovan's attachment to the Countess.
Mm-hmm.
Enter Lady Gaga.
Your boy has a jawline for days.
I like her character throughout. And I don't know, Lady Gaga is like almost an ethereal presence in the show.
Oh, she's an alien. You know, she really is. She just comes down and she does her thing. And number one, I mean, I'm a huge Hunger fan. So clearly her and Donovan, and even Liz, I would say, comes from that idea of the Hunger. Okay. Just because of the, it's just pure glamour. Mm. So I would honestly put those three characters together coming from the same kind of movie, just because they're so glamorous and they're so like cool, and you see them and you're like, I want to be them.
Yeah. And when they're on screen, especially collectively, the soundtrack harkens right to that. The Hunger was Tony Scott, right? I think it was an early Tony Scott flick. But yeah, no, the music is all like retro synth. It's funny. The show, it's a small miracle that it works considering how many different components are thrown together.
Yeah.
And so it's this two-story set. The lobby is overlooked by balconies. Mm-hmm. The carpet is right out of The Shining.
Yes.
All the furniture is perfect. The rooms seem to vary between like the slightly more glamorous ones that the tenants have.
Yeah.
And then the sad ones that they put out-of-towners in when they legitimately book a room.
Right, right.
Who the hell are you?
Now that's the wrong question. What you should be asking is, who was I?
Somebody order room service.
I was the queen of them all.
No, we ordered hookers.
Get on your knees.
I don't get on my knees for no man.
Cut! Check the gate.
Woo! That look good.
I'd come to Hollywood with barely a high school education and no prospects. It wasn't long before I was a star.
And the cast is further filled out with Angela Bassett.
Yeah.
Comes in, not in the first two episodes, but Angela Bassett is playing Ramona Royale. And she's coming straight out of the 70s from Pam Grier blaxploitation films like Coffee or Foxy Brown.
Right.
And I loved her character. And I thought it was especially appropriate, fitting that she is playing a vampire. And Angela Bassett, like, go back and watch What's Love Got to Do with It. She hasn't aged.
She looks, I think, better today.
She might. She might. She's holding up those arms. Holy shit.
Yeah. She looks amazing.
Those
amazing.
Are Michelle Obama arms.
She's got. Hell yeah. Oh, yeah. Those are serious arms. No, she's in it. She's doing that character and that voice 100% of the time as well.
Yeah, which brought into a modern context in this hotel. Again, we're going to keep coming up to the idea that all these components should not fit together.
Right.
But like when she is having conversations with March, who's of the 20s, it's surreal. Like, she is from the 70s. He is from the 20s. We are watching this in 2016. None of this should work.
Right, but it totally does. I mean, that's what I love, you know, and I was talking earlier about the guys from The Hunger, from Gaga and Donovan together. When they talk with J.P. March, it's just like, they're so smooth and they're so cool. And J.P. March is doing that old-timey shenanigans thing. And it's, to me, like, it's almost like the actor, even though you have to listen to each other, it's how I don't understand how they can be listening to each other and doing the voices and doing the character. Like, I mean, there's a lot to be commended in this.
Terrible accident. Room 51. Just ghastly.
Yeah. Further padded out, the cast includes Mare Winningham as Hazel.
Who I love seeing Mare Winningham in anything. I get so excited when I see her.
She's kind of adorable. I mean, she's almost comic relief in like how unflinchingly positive she is.
Yes.
And
she loves cleaning things.
She can't wait. Like, she just, as soon as a murder happens, she is excited to get in there.
And she's trying to figure out how to clean it. I love her. She is in one of my most favorite movies, you know, and that's St. Elmo's Fire. And so I'm excited. Whenever I see her, I get like so excited. And I thought she was only going to be in like one episode or something. And then she came and she's like in almost every episode. And I loved her so much.
Yeah, it's funny that she's noted as a special guest star, but I think she is in every episode.
She's in, I think, every episode.
Yeah. Yeah. They should have given her full credit. But yeah, no, she's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Last out of the main, I think, series people would be Fenn Wittrock, who I first saw in Freak Show, American Horror Story Freak Show.
Okay, yeah.
I loved him in that.
That's funny. I didn't.
We'll be watching it again. So you have to because of the show. I think he's like really brilliant.
I'm on the fence. I thought he was fine in this. I wasn't wild about either of the two characters he plays. He plays a model and like a bad boy model.
But I think he's so silly and because, you know, I had a friend who was a male model for a lot of years and how he acted. It was absurd and like a baby child running around that was just very, very handsome. And that's
like a mimbo. Like, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, a mimbo. And so when he throws like Fenn Wittrock at the very, I think, first episode throws some tantrum like a child. And I go, oh, yeah, that is my friend. I definitely get that.
Yeah, I don't know. I did come to like him on account of like we get a little bit of like the soft underbelly when he's when he's sort of falling for Liz. I really like those two together.
Yeah.
And actually on that note,
it's a beautiful story.
I mean, Ryan Murphy, you know, is famously behind Glee and even more recently American Crime Story. They did the OJ story, but like he is a part and fan of the LGBT community and the themes throughout this season are so progressive.
Oh, totally. There was many times, even in that very first episode, I go, I can't believe this is on TV. This is so, usually someone who's LGBT and a character that way is treated like a sideshow or treated maybe like a sexless eunuch, something
like
that.
Or like a side character who's there for some exposition, but it's just kind of like a comic relief.
Like full stories and full beautiful stories of these people's life here.
Yeah, it's funny, by the, I think it might have been the last episode or the second to last episode, I was just kind of like pulling back and I was like, I am watching a vampire bisexual lesbian relationship play out. And these are like two people with all the baggage in the world, just kind of relating to each other and sort of the way two people have known each other for an eternity, just like trying to make it work. Like, you know, these two characters really struggling. They just happen to be all those other things, but holy shit, like this was, you know, it's not network television. It's like basic cable, but still.
But still, it's a mainstream show and it gets good ratings.
So the very first episode was written and directed by Ryan Murphy. Mm-hmm. It was co-written by Brad Falchuk. It introduces most of the characters, especially the graphic that I'm sure has come up on the commercials because it's one of the most terrifying elements, but a man in the bed.
Yeah, the monster man in the bed. Very scary.
Yeah.
Doesn't have anything to do with anything pretty much for the rest of the show, but it's cool. Whatever.
No, he's
it's
almost
there to
like,
scare you.
Yeah, he's almost like wallpaper to this hotel. Like, he's just part of it. I don't think they ever explain.
No.
Creepy guy.
You see him one more time. That's
well, you see him, blurry here and there. There are a little bit of flashes here and there. Actually, on the note of like blurry flashes, One of the things I did not like about season two was the editing and some of the like jittery camera work.
Okay.
This show is far more like paced and calm in the telling. I think they probably kind of embrace the idea that like there's a lot of shit going on. These characters are speaking in very peculiar accents. Let's not draw attention away from that.
Yeah, no, it's very
shaky cam, fast cuts.
Back in the pocket, kind of.
Yeah,
observing.
And I think also the setting, I mean, so much attention to detail was put into like the hallways and the lobbies and the rooms. So, yeah, I'm grateful for that. Towards the end, it got a little over the top with like really conspicuous Dutch angles.
Yes.
But I'll take it.
Yeah, there's quite a few times where you're very much reminded you're in a hotel hallway and this is very similar to The Overlook. Don't you forget, this is The Shining. And so it does kind of slam that in your face towards the end, but I don't care. I love this thing.
Yeah. The first episode has a lot of sex and when it comes to vampires having said sex, it is bloody. I like, it's funny.
That is one of my most favorite scenes of anything I've ever seen. That scene is so fucking cool. The song from She Wants Revenge is the main song, and it really sets up Donovan, Lady Gaga, and this lifestyle that they have. And you go, they're murdering, but you're like, I kind of want to be involved.
They're murdering hedonists who just like go out, scout another couple to take home. Yeah. And like, you know, they're not complete monsters. They have sex with them first.
Yeah. I mean, they're being cool to everybody involved, you know. It's just one of those scenes where you just go, those guys are fucking cool.
Yeah, and you get introduced to Lady Gaga's knife glove.
Yes.
Yeah, which plays throughout the season. And it's funny, for as much, like, I would, the moment she puts on the gloves, I'd never get all that close to her.
Well, that's the thing, is she's like so very, very strange. And they pick up this couple in the beginning in the park. They're watching Nosferatu in the park. But like, these people are fucking weirdos. I mean, part of me probably still would go home with them because, holy crap, they're really good looking. But at the same time, you kind of know you've signed your death sentence.
Yeah,
there.
This sex better be worth it.
Yeah, but I think it will be. I think it would be between those two. I wouldn't be worried.
Yeah, the throat slitting, and when we go back through these, I'll be paying close attention because it seems like Lady Gaga's go-to move is the across the throat, like not even like the jugular's off to the side.
Yeah,
that arterial vein is
someone
off to the side.
Does
so
that
she
later.
Is,
someone yeah. else, that's his favorite thing, and it shoots out like a goddamn fountain every time he does it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, she's never. I'm actually always impressed by how little blood she gets on her when she's like wearing
she's
a proper
a professional.
Going out clothes.
She's been doing this for a long time.
Fair point. She's been doing it over.
And like, she's
like
this
nearly
Daphne
years.
Guinness character, so she probably doesn't want to get blood all over her fancy clothes. We're also introduced to Sally, which is Sarah Paulson, and we find out how she died and how she's connected with Donovan and the hotel.
Yeah, Kathy Bates and her. It's funny that as much as Liz, played by Dennis O'Hare, and Kathy Bates have like a back and forth rapport, mm-hmm. Sally and Iris have their own like antagonist relationship, and we get some glimpses into why. Iris is very much alive and is taking care of this hotel. I mean, for the sake of getting a glimpse at her son every once in a while, but not really maintaining much of a relationship. But Sally is trapped there because fucking Iris had something to say about her dealings with her son, Donovan. So that kind of draws attention to the idea that, like I mentioned before, the hotel is kind of this macabre anchor for anyone who's ever been through there who is, say, of a murderous type. We mentioned Ramirez and mm-hmm. the original hotel. Characters who have passed through there when they were living, when they're dead, they might sort of hearken back. In this case, we get the episode that we'll talk about in a minute. But the Devil's Night episode kind of shows, like, the return to the Cortez idea, but everybody
but it's
else
only on
who,
one night a year,
right? For those who have like gone away,
right?
However, those who die in the hotel, it becomes their prison,
right?
And so the hotel is just like I'm always surprised that, well, you know what, in all fairness, every time Kathy Bates is asked, she does have to point out that they're near capacity.
Yes. they're in most of the rooms.
These rooms are completely inhabited by ghosts.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really cool because it uses the same set of rules as Murder House.
Okay, yeah.
Which is great, and there's a great tie-in later on in the season with Murder House as well.
Yeah, Ryan Murphy's mentioned that in one way or another, all these stories exist in the same universe. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of playing in the same sandbox. In that case, Murder House was in L.A., does feature back to, like, the 20s and Black Dahlia era. So that comes into play later.
And we even have the same realtor who seems to specialize in these terrible, awful things. Same realtor from Murder House is in there. And she shows Cheyenne Jackson and brings Cheyenne Jackson kind of into the fold. He's going to be the new owner of the hotel.
Which, yeah, throws everybody in a tizzy. I guess up to this point, they don't really, you know, they kind of gloss over a couple details as far as like, well, who owned this technically?
I assume because Gaga does.
Wasn't really the Countess. It doesn't sound like she had a say in the matter.
I I don't understand, but so, I don't care.
Yeah, details like that are inconsequential. So, yeah, so when we're introduced to Cheyenne Jackson as Will Drake, he's like a very well-to-do fashion designer,
right,
and he's got the money, so he wants to, like, revitalize this place. Except, you know, ghosts are pretty set in their ways.
Yeah, they don't seem to like it. Donovan certainly doesn't like it because he's now having to share with Lady Gaga.
Yeah, and I think he's seen other people come and go. Like, Lady Gaga, right, definitely sort of takes pets, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, very handsome fellas, but they are all kind of property.
Yeah, and Donovan is her latest thing, so he's kind of like, no, not me. And if you had any wonder if they were actually from The Hunger or not, clearly, it's playing Bauhaus. It's playing Bela Lugosi's Dead. There's no way you can argue that that's who those two people are.
So we are literally running out of time for this lunch hour.
Because the lunch hour reviews are done on our lunch hour.
We scarf down lunch and then throw up the mics. The mics, not the food. But that said, we have run out of time. So in 2 weeks, we're going to come back with the episode breakdown. Without too much spoilers, we're not really going to overdo it.
But there's so much to talk about on this show. I didn't even get into the music. I didn't even get into the music, Darren.
Well, a little bit. I mean, you talked about Bela Lugosi's Dead and 80s throwback new wave. But
there's so many. There's so many songs.
But yeah, no. All these, it's funny that, like, we've gotten through character breakdowns, and you know what, that's good. The pilot episode does kind of the slow introduction of the idea and the sort of throw everything up in the air premise that the hotel is going to be sold and changed, and that's everybody's nightmare.
Plus, it gives the listener 2 weeks now to watch everything.
Watch some of the show. Yeah. So we'll be joining you in 2 weeks with the second part of our American Horror Story retrospective this season, Hotel. We are on all the social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, no Snapchat, but we are on YouTube.
Yeah.
We are typically at Rance Macabre. Our website is therancemacabre.com. While you're at it, find us on iTunes and give us a review. That'd be really nice of you to sort of, pay it forward. That's it, right? I covered everything. Yeah.
I think that's what we do. That's what we do.
Wrap this up and read this closing outro. You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario, that's me, and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
Can tear you apart.